Okay. Well, just to reiterate, last time we agreed that we push back the paper due dates from this Wednesday to the Monday after break. So that's Monday, March 8th, doing class. And are there any questions about the papers, the next papers that are due? They're going to be a little bit longer than the ones from last time. And I want to reiterate that I'm glad to meet with people if you want to come to my office hours today after class or this week. So I'm happy to make appointments. And I want to thank you guys for filling out the survey. It was really very helpful. A couple of things came out of it. One was that pretty much everybody was in favor of doing more small groups. That was very popular. So I'm going to try and make sure that we do some of that at least once every time in class. And I think that's, you know, it's something I've been noticing too. It's hard to get people to participate when we're all in a big group. And as I said at the beginning of class, a couple of people mentioned that it might be easier to speak up in the whole class setting if we actually moved closer together. I was just wondering if people thought that was a good idea. We have some definite no's. How about a show of hands? How many people would be against moving closer up to the front? Couple. Any people, and how many, you want to try that again? Like three?
No's,
yeah.
Everybody.
Okay, what about yeses? I know there are some yeses out there. You don't have to be shy. Okay, well, looks like we have sort of a sticking point. People who want to say yes aren't speaking out in favor of it. So we're going to stay in this format for the time being. I might try and force you a little bit later on. Another thing that came out is a lot of people said they appreciated having a summary of the lecture at the beginning of the readings at the beginning of class. And so I'm going to be trying to do some more of that, make sure that we go over the structure of the readings for you. And also, maybe I should emphasize, you should try and interrupt me if there are some points of unclarity, just jump in and you know, yell and let me know. Other points. As for the readings, there was a lot of variation. There were some people speaking out in favor of just about everything. Some people wanted less of the historical stuff and more modern stuff, and some people wanted the reverse. But overall, there was a pretty good spread for what people liked in the readings. So, and homework, most people seem to think that it was helping a bit. So we'll keep on with that. We might try and tone down the number of questions for later on. So, but if you have more suggestions later on, please do get back to me, okay? Okay, I wanted to start out with just outlining what the Dennett reading was, the structure of the Dennett reading for you, and then we're going to break down into small groups and discuss it in the second half of the class. So, this particular reading now is it gives us a way of summing up some of the issues that we've been talking about in the past few weeks. Issues about who I am at a particular time, what makes me the particular person I am at a time, which we were discussing under the heading of the unity of consciousness. So we were. So on the unity of consciousness readings, we were talking about Descartes, Hume, and Nagel. This also brings together a question about who I am through time, or over time. Which we've been discussing under the rubric of personal identity. And there, the people that we've been looking at are Perry, Williams, and Parfit. Right. And both of these are, both of these are being picked up by, both of these things are being picked up by Dennett, who's asking the question, who am I? And he's talking both about who you are at a particular time and who you are through time in his examples. And just to give us just to remind you, the various kinds of theory that we've been looking at here, both for the unity of consciousness and personal identity, have some similar themes. Similar sorts of theories have been proposed. So some people have thought that what explains who you are, what makes you the particular individual that you are at a particular time, is that you have a distinctive immaterial soul, which unifies your consciousness, all your conscious experiences at a time, and makes you the very person you are from the moment that you are born to the moment that you cease to exist. There's a body theory and the brain theory. What makes you the very person that you are is that you have this particular ongoing body that continues from your birth until your death, or this particular brain, and that might explain, in particular the brain, might explain the unity of your consciousness at a particular time. What makes all of your thoughts and feelings belong to one particular person? And finally, there's in each of these themes, we looked at one thinker who was claiming that what unifies your consciousness at a time and through time is not any of these particular items, these particular objects that last through time, but rather the connections among your thoughts and feelings. So, basically, the final theory that we've been looking at is that what makes you the very person that you are, is a particular point of view that is integrates various of your thoughts and feelings with each other. So, for instance, you remember Nagel, that was his view about what makes you the very one person at a particular time, is that your thoughts and feelings are integrated in a particular way. They can be more or less integrated. They could be more or less in communication with each other. But what makes for your personal identity at a particular time is just the relations among your thoughts and feelings. And similarly, Derek Parfit argued that through time, there's no hard and fast yes or no fact about you, who you are. It's who you are depends on how well integrated your thoughts and feelings are over time. The more psychological connections you have with a past or future person, the more you are quote unquote identical with that person, or the more you are a survivor of that person. But there's no hard and fast yes or no answer to the question of, is that person you in the past or the future? So Nagel and Parfit are both taking a similar sort of line on this. And in fact, Dennett is very sympathetic to that line. What he does, though, is he starts by giving us this thought experiment. Well, science fiction. He says, he tells us a story where he has been recruited by NASA for this supersonic tunneling underground device test, right? This STUD is his acronym. What he's supposed to do is he's supposed to participate in this experiment where he donates his brain. His brain is separated from his body, and then his body goes on this mission to dismantle a missile underground, right? And so the first thought experiment is where he tells us a story where his brain and his body are separated. And we're supposed to ask, okay, where are you? Where is Dennett located? Once his brain and his body are in separate locations, where is Dennett? And this gives us a new way in to trying to decide among these various theories of personal identity. The experiment is he loses contact with his body. So his body, the radio connections between his brain and his body start going on the fritz, and all of a sudden he realizes, you know, he thinks for a moment that he's about to die, and then he realizes, oh, wait, I'm actually in Houston, right? He thinks he's in the... At that point, he no longer identifies with where he is at the... You know, where his body is, which is underground working on this missile, but he identifies with his brain back in Houston in this little metallic tub full of electrodes. And so at that point, he comes up with a new kind of view about where he is, which should influence his view about who he is, what kind of a thing he is. Finally, give him a new human body, and he gets at the same time a spare computer brain. Okay, and at the very end, the brain and the two sort of brains that are controlling this body go out of sync. And so it looks like at that point he's got two brains and one body. So he's giving us a range of puzzle cases and at each stage we're asked, well, where is he? Where is Dennett? And he's trying to pump our intuitions in this way, get us thinking about this case from a new angle. this question about where am I located. It's supposed to help us come to some sort of decision about what kind of thing Dennett is, that individual thing. And he proposes a number of different solutions to this, and this is what I'd like to discuss in small groups about how plausible each of these solutions is. Okay, so right about page 220, he says, maybe he's located wherever his brain is located. Wherever his body is located. His body calls his body Hamlet and his brain Yorick. So he says, okay, maybe I am where my body is. In that case, my body is me. And then he thinks, well, maybe it's the opposite. Maybe it's not my body that's me, because, you know, after all, couldn't I get a body transplant? Second suggestion is maybe my brain is me. Wherever my brain is, there am I. But he finds this hard to believe, because as he's sitting there, you know, he's got his brain in a vat, and his body is walking all over, and he thinks, well, I can't be where my brain is. You put my brain in prison, and I don't care. I seem to be, you know, it seems obvious that where I am is the place where I see, feel, hear, touch, talk, you know, where my body is. So he's not very satisfied with the second solution either. A third solution is, I am wherever my point of view is. That is, wherever it seems to me that I, wherever it seems like here to me is where I am. So if it seems to you that you're walking around the labs at Houston, it doesn't seem to you that you're in this tank of nutrients, floating in a tank of nutrients, and that's the way it seems to Dennett when his brain is separated from his body, well then, it's just in virtue of the fact that it seems to you that you're walking around, that you are walking around. You're located where it seems to you that you're located. He's not very satisfied with that one either. He's a little bit worried about it, partly because he thinks, well, can't I be wrong about where I am? Can't I make mistakes about this? And you can think about, he mentions these illusions that you can have with, simulated mechanical arms and so on, where you actually feel the tension of the resistance of the object you're trying to move, and you can feel the drag and pull of the mechanical devices that you're manipulating, and you project yourself into the mechanical device. But he says that would be just seeming. Even if you identified fully with these mechanical arms, if you are in a body, you know, sitting on, say, a boat, and you're manipulating mechanical arms under a device that's crawling on the ocean floor, it seems right to say that it may seem to you that you're down on the ocean floor, but in fact you really are up on the boat manipulating these things. So he's worried that the view that your point of view is where you are must be wrong, because you can be wrong about, you can have these illusions about where you are. So then around page 221, he comes up with a new idea. This is as his body is flying off to go recover the missile. He says, okay, I'm getting used to this now. It's not such a great conundrum. I don't have to choose between the location of my body and the location of my brain. I can just think of myself as composed of both body and brain. So I'm, you know, part of me is in Houston, and part of me is, where was he flying off to? Phoenix? Someplace else. And I'm in both places. I'm partly in one place and partly in the other place. So, on this view, I don't have to choose. I'm composed of both my body and my brain. It's like a great big scattered device. We're familiar with various machines that can be located in different places. You have a power plant, and it might be connected up with some other power-generating source, and both of them together constitute the power-generating machine. Or you can think of one of those little tiny sailboats that it's controlled by a remote control operator. Well, the device, you know, mechanical sailboat, is located both in the hand of the person who's manipulating it and partly on the pond where the sailboat is being driven around. The device is in, you know, it's a scattered device. It's in two places. Similarly, he thinks, okay, I'm both brain and body, so I don't have to choose. But he fails to be satisfied with that after his body goes on the fritz. So around page 224, he says his body starts losing contact with his brain, and you know, one by one the connections are severed, and he gets this feeling of complete panic and disorientation. And he thinks he's about to die, and then he realizes, wait a second, I'm not in Phoenix at all. I'm back in Houston. I am my brain in this little hermetic vat. That's where I'm located. And then he's not actually reverting to the brain theory at that point. He thinks he's made a big philosophical discovery. He thinks that he's... His idea is that somehow he is a kind of immaterial soul, but he's got a very special understanding of this soul. He calls it his center of gravity. And what he seems to mean by that is that he wants to espouse purely physicalistic principles here, but so he thinks that he's located where one of his physical parts is. Remember, Descartes, who had an immaterial conception of the soul, thought that souls didn't have to be located anywhere in space. Dennett, let me put this in sort of quotation marks. Dennett's idea of a soul is different. He thinks of it as something like a point of view, but not the kind of point of view that he mentioned at the beginning, number three here. His idea of a center of gravity is like a point of view, but you can be wrong about it. So he thinks, right, after his disconnections, after his body starts getting disconnected from his brain, he's still thinking that he's in Houston. He's still thinking that he's in Phoenix underground. But then it occurs to him that he's wrong about that. And he corrects himself. He says, no, wait, I can't be in Phoenix underground. That body, I don't have any sort of connection with that body anymore. He remembers that his brain is back in Houston, and then he sort of re-identifies himself with the brain. He starts thinking, okay, I must be that brain. And it's not just that he was that brain when he thinks it. So as soon as the thought occurs to him, oh, I must be the brain, I must be where the brain is, that sort of switches his location. His idea is, no, as soon as the connections started being severed between the body and the brain, he should have been locating himself and identifying with himself as the brain in Houston. So the center of gravity looks like something like a corrected point of view. So it's like three, except it's corrected for these possible errors that you can make about where you identify yourself. So each of these options that he lays out presents one way of reacting to the brain and body, separate brain and body scenario. And what I'd like to do is to break down into smaller groups and see if you can decide whether what you think of each of these scenarios, which one is the most plausible. For each one, you get to a different decision about where you are if you're Dennett. The first one locates you with your body. Second one locates you wherever your brain is. The third one locates wherever you currently think you are. The fourth one says that you are any place where any part of you is. So if you're composed of two parts, a body and a brain, you're both places. And the fifth one locates you wherever your point of view should be. And it's a little bit mysterious how exactly we're supposed to decide where your point of view should be. But he thinks he has an answer in this case. So what I'd like to do now is do our habitual thing, is break down into groups of four or five at each of the corners and discuss this before we go on to talking about the cases at the end, which sort of complicated matters, where he's got... Because in those cases, Dennett gets this extra body, this new body with this extra spare brain. But in those cases too, we're going to have to take a look at these sorts of theories and figure out which one does best justice to that kind of case. Okay, you want to break down?
Standard, but we didn't really know what that was. So, with what we could think of as being the best set standard, we liked it. Mm-hmm.
So, you think it's not just for the case where the connections start fizzling out, mm-hmm. but it works for all of the cases. So you are wherever sort of the center of gravity for you is.
Yeah.
What about other groups?
We went with four, more or less.
Body plus brain, so you're partly where your body is and
right.
Partly where your brain is.
Right, because when they were together, like right in the beginning, performing the operation, he knew exactly where he was, he knew everything about himself. Then when he got separated, he still had a specific point of view,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't know which one, that's when he started questioning it. And then when everything got severed, he didn't really have a body, you know? It was just like, wow, I don't have a body, and he seemed just so, like, his contact was, he didn't understand anything. He was just like, what's this, what's that? All he could do was think, and it didn't seem like he really had any point of view. He didn't really have much of an identity. And then once the new body came, it was like, it's a new body, and it was kind of complete, but then it got all kind of jumbled with the two different brains.
Okay, so your thought is, when the body starts losing contact, the body just dies, and so he's only located in Houston, where his brain is.
Right.
Even before the brain, the body completely dies. Do you think that's right? If the connection is severed, he's located where the brain is.
What do you mean?
Well, it probably takes his body a while to actually, completely die.
Right.
After the connection is severed.
Right.
So, before his body completely dies, but the connections are severed, do you think he's in both places, or do you think he's in just in Houston?
Well, he's partly in both. I mean, he's predominantly, most of him, the part of him where everything goes on, everyone
mm-hmm.
thinks. I mean, his body is alive and breathing, so that's part of him that's alive and...
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was in Tulsa. Is that where it was?
I don't remember exactly.
So that's still alive, so that's still there. But once that dies, it doesn't know where it is then, or when that point exactly comes, then everything that's left of him is what's in Houston.
Okay, so you're inclined to think that still, before it dies, it's located in two places.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you guys would think, in going for number five, you're inclined to think when the severing comes, he's located actually where his brain is, not in both places. Yes. And before the severing comes, where would you say the center of gravity is?
Before he loses communication
mm-hmm.
with the body.
Okay, so it travels back and forth depending on where his point of view should be. What about you guys? What did you come up with?
We went with number five as well. Pretty much the same reasons as them. And like you said, the severing.
Mm-hmm.
It's with the body.
So when the severing comes, he's wholly with his brain. Not at all with the living body that's just completely disconnected. What about you guys?
I don't think we actually came up with one that we totally liked.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of people, I guess, like five, but we didn't totally understand five and how it varied from regular point of view. So we couldn't really accept that one. But I don't know.
You guys were also pretty tempted, I know you were, by just the straight brain theory. I'm wondering whether there could be a comeback for the brain theory against this intuition about you are where your point of view is.
I felt like number five combined the two and three. It's your brain, but then it's your point of view, but then your brain is what is correcting itself. I don't know if that helps with
that. So how is it combine the two?
Because it's your point of view, like you said, and then it's corrected. It's logical thinking is what's correcting it, and that's basically your brain. And when all the time the perspective that we're getting is from the brain, so I feel like that's what's actively correcting the point of view.
Well, your brain is doing all of the thinking, right?
Yeah.
But I'm wondering how exactly number five can be a combination of two and three.
If I didn't explain it.
Well, the thing is, two says you are just identical to your brain. Your body is just this kind of, it's like having an artificial limb. It's no more you than an artificial limb is, or no more you than your clothes are. So, looks like number five, and sort of the point of view corrected point of view, center of gravity view, doesn't want to take that kind of view about what you are. They don't want to say, advocate of number five doesn't want to say, you're wholly identified with your brain, irrespective of where you think you are. So number three, the advocate of number two, the brain theory would say, it's just an illusion to think that you are walking around underground. That's completely just as much an illusion as if you were in this you're controlling this you're on this boat controlling this robot underseas with this virtual reality kind of manipulation. On that kind of case, you really are up on the boat, however much it might seem virtual reality-wise that you were on the sea floor. And the advocate number two says, it's the same thing with your brain. You are wherever your brain is, even though it may seem that you're completely, you're in a completely another place altogether. So, I think that it's hard to combine two and three. They've got really, the advocate number three takes, well, look, you are wherever you think you are. Where you are, who you are, depends on your actual point of view, how it seems to you. A couple of people, I think you were saying, a problem for number three would be that, how can you be where it seems to you? Because in dreams, for instance, you're clearly not. Is that?
Yeah, that was just what I said.
What do people think? Is it, could you be, is that a good objection to the number three? Well, and a lot of people are really tempted by the idea that you are this sort of immaterial thing, the center of gravity. How exactly do you think we should cast out the idea of, you know, where your center of gravity should be? How do you decide that you were wrong, that your center of gravity, how can you ever just, you know, decide that you're wrong about where your center of gravity is? Standard for sort of correcting yourself is. So in the case of a dream, you're dreaming that you're on Mars. And maybe it's a completely, absolutely lifelike dream. You're imagining it vividly and it's completely true. But Mars is like that. But you're actually, you want to say you're actually at home in bed under the covers asleep. How is it? Why is that the right answer? Why is the center of gravity? Why is your center of gravity still here on Earth, even though you're dreaming about Mars?
Because it's not real. It's not really happening. Your point of view isn't only like you looking at Mars. It's what that point of view is that your body's up there on Mars and you're interacting with things like feeling them, looking at them,
mm-hmm.
hearing them, smelling them, whatever. But the fact is, like, that's not really happening. That's not what's really going on. Where your body really is under the covers. And because of that, you can't see, and you can't hear, and you can't do any of that stuff
mm-hmm.
that you're dreaming. So it's not real. That's why you don't take it as real.
Okay, so maybe that's a different way of understanding what a point of view is. A point of view is where the place where all the sensory information is coming in.
Right.
So in the case of the body,
That's not where you are, but I'm saying in that particular case, you can't take a dream you can't say that your brain is up on Mars, and you can't
mm-hmm.
say that your point of view is up on Mars, because that's just an illusion, you know? Like, if somebody goes and, like, hypnotizes me or something, that doesn't mean that that's the way things are, it's just an illusion.
But that's your point of view, though. You'll still say, I mean, if you ask a dream person where they are, they'll say wherever you're dreaming that you are, whether or not your body's there.
Well, and then you could go, like, the same thing that happened with Lyra was the Perry's dialogues. It's
mm-hmm.
like, is that your point of view, is that caused the right way or the wrong way? Or is it your seeming point of view? You could go back to that sort of argument, you know?
But that's not really the argument. All it's saying is that number three is like,
wherever you're thinking you are, that's where you are.
Right. I think that's a good point. I think actually both of these are really good points because Yair could be giving us a new way of trying to figure out where your real point of view is. Your point of view, if the seeming point of view is actually coming from real sensory input, in the case, and that is the case with the with when your body is separated from your brain, the body is gathering real sensory input. It's got a real, you know, point of view on the world. Whereas in the dreaming case, you're just imagining input. There isn't any real input. So that might be a way of distinguishing number three from number five. Number five says, look, in order to have a point of view, you have to have real input coming into you. And in the case where the link got severed between the body and the brain, you don't have any more real input going in to that distant body. So you don't have an apparent point of view that's distinct from where your actual mental processing is taking place back in the brain. Yeah.
I had a question about that, about how he came about with number five. Once the body and the brain got severed and separated, he was talking about a connection, how he was losing the connection. But
mm-hmm.
what type of connection did they have? I was wondering about that because in the examples that you gave, like a remote control and then the
mm-hmm.
car or whatever, the remote control is controlling the car, but the brain would control
mm-hmm.
a body, as it seemed in that example. So, like, what kind of connection did they have?
It's supposed to be something just like that. He says it's radio connection. Between
so like if he was
neurons.
Thinking to raise the arm would raise.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, something, whatever the, you've got, for all of your, it's kind of an outrageously complex and probably technologically impossible feat,
what's
but
this?
The idea is that for every of your neurons coming, output neurons, you've got a little transmitter attached that would transmit it to the other end of the nerve, which would help control your muscles in the body, and then vice versa. For every nerve and sensory neuron, you have another transmitter going back to hooking it up to the right place in the brain. So it's just like these remote control cars and so on. But this raises another, this suggestion, your suggestion, that you are wherever your real sensory input is being channeled from.
I don't really believe in the whole point of view thing to begin with. But
okay.
I'm saying just, like what I was saying was just kind of in response to your whole dream thing.
Okay, you know, that's okay. You don't have to, I'm not saying, you know, it's your final considered opinion. It was just reaction to this point. But
just relax.
one question it raises for me at least is, what do we say about the person who's controlling the robot under the sea, who's on the ship, and has got these connections with the robot under sea, and it seems to that person in some ways that she is down on the sea floor, that she can see things down there, that she can move around, pick things up, drag them. And she's getting real sensory input from down there, and real, you know, really manipulating a body down there. Should the advocate of the point of view, center of gravity view, say that that person is partly on the seafloor, partly up on the ship, or wholly down on the seafloor?
What's on top of the ship? Just the brain?
No, the whole body. The person's there, you know.
Oh, like a, do it like a machine is down on the bottom.
Yeah, the machine is down on the bottom. The person is up on top, and she's got, you know, all these levers. It's like a really high tech video game.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she pulls and pushes as if she were down on the bottom, and it starts to feel to her as if she's really down there. She kind of identifies with the machine down there. It's like a virtual reality machine for her. Does that make her partly down there on the seafloor, do you think?
I don't think so. I think for one thing, like, she'll have certain sensory inputs from down on the seafloor, but, like,
mm-hmm.
if someone calls out her name up on the ship,
mm-hmm.
she's going to be, like, she'll respond to that. When just the brain sitting in the bed, if someone calls your name to the
mm-hmm.
brain, there's
mm-hmm.
going to be no response whatsoever.
So the fact that she's got a point of view, a situated perspective up on the ship,
yeah.
and a situated perspective down on the seafloor, do you want to say that it's only the one on the ship that's really real?
Yeah.
Does that seem right to other people? And you might think, well, you know, she's partly in two places. The center of gravity is kind of divided in this kind of case. Because you've got both the ability to respond and to things going on the ship and the ability and readiness to respond to things down on the seafloor. You've got this sort of two-part consciousness. Or maybe it depends on where you're focusing your attention.
I agree, like, temporarily, like, she feels that, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's a machine, and after, it'll come up, and she'll be herself, and you gotta say something about, like, you know, I think she'd feel like she's down there, you know, and she'd feel like a part, and physically she'd feel down there, but I think if you asked her straight out, like, where are you, she'd be, like, on the boat. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and if you asked the machine, obviously the machine wouldn't answer anything.
So she's always somewhat aware of her
I mean, she's just
body.
When you do virtual reality, you're devoting your consciousness and all your physical energy towards moving a machine.
Mm-hmm. Would it make a difference, you think, if she went into sort of a trance? You know, people can get so concentrated on what they're doing that, you know, you nudge them or you say something to them and they just completely ignore you. If she was so bound up in what was going on under the sea, would it make sense then? Would it be like having a remote control body?
Can you, I mean, is temporarily an acceptable answer, I think?
Yeah, well, I think that the shifting center of gravity point of view is something that can change, that can move from one place to another in an instant. I mean, that's what Dennett's idea was. He said, during this example where the body is underground in Tulsa, and all of a sudden the connections start going on the fritz, he says, "Well, look, his center of gravity shifted in an instant back to the vat. It didn't take any time. It doesn't, you know, there's no material transfer of anything that has to take place." So it looks like, you know, the time it takes, or the time aspect doesn't, and distance travel doesn't make any difference for this kind of view to work. I wanna take a few minutes just to talk about for next time. I'd like to follow up next time to talk about the next stage of this thought experiment, taking it on to the stage where he's got a new spare brain, which is actually a computer, and whether that's actually just one person or two people, and whether you can actually, one word you might have is whether the computer is actually doing any thinking at all, and whether you can have one person with these two brains. So that's what I want to concentrate on next time. And I wanted to find out if there'd be some people willing to volunteer to lead the discussion for that next time.
I'll do it.
Okay. Also, some have suggested that we might just give a sign-up sheet and let you sign up beforehand for the rest of the presentations. Would that be Would people like to do that, or would you like to continue doing it sort of after we've had a chance to do the meetings?
Let's do a summary.
Let me take a vote. How many people haven't done a presentation so far? Okay. Of the people who haven't done the presentation so far, how many would like to do sign-up sheet now in advance of the meetings, and versus how many people would like to wait until you do the meetings? So, sign-up sheet now. How many people for a sign-up sheet now? One?
Two?
How many people for wait three?
Three.
Wait
Come
and
on,
see.
People.
Here
we go. Oh,
look. Wait, see, that was one, two, three,
four.
Oh, I think the wait and see's have it.
You sent me around the side. I wasn't on the other side.
What would you like to?
I'd say mid March, like late March.
What is this
event? Let's go. I know when you're going.
Spare brain idea. Is that even a starting point? A second kind of idea. One of these brains, quote unquote, is supposed to be a computer. Could a computer actually be a person? Could it have thoughts and feelings and could that even be part of it? Could it be a person? Could it be part of a person? So that's another worry. And then the final worry is, well, what kind of a theory should we think is true in order to, you know, describe this person? Is it, if we take Dennett's word, it's one person, two brains, one artificial and one real. Is it the point of view, number five, that he's appealing to here?
Are we applying the theory?
Yeah, I mean, that might be a harder thing to get a grip on, but that's another direction to take. What should the theory say about this? About this kind of case, and you know, what seems plausible, and then when the two come apart, that's kind of the case that that Parfit was thinking about, where you have you've got a consciousness that divides, and they're both going to be survivors of you, and also two people in one body. So that's also kind of a split brain case. So that's another place to wonder about. What should we say about that kind of case? Are there really two people or one people? So, I mean, these are just sort of starting points to get you thinking about what you can concentrate on, one or two
tonight?
Points of this.
You
have
got a great material.
Are you guys are doing...
Oh, yes, thank you.
And Grace is sick.
Okay, thanks.
Because I'm taking a class.
Feeling better. It's a bad time to be sick.
It's a 125 course.
Yes, I do. Where is it? She's in my bag.
Yeah, from the Appalachian. The Appalachian. I think it's very interesting.
What's your name?
I have no idea. Yeah. It's a very interesting question. class. I really like it.
It's too early in the morning, but besides that.
How many people are in the class?
I'm doing my report on the class. We all have to do like a 10-12 page report with the whole data collection report and the research proposal and all that. And I think I'm doing mine on sexual slang, so it should be pretty interesting. But like we always talk about, what are you guys looking for?
What are we looking for? This is a project.